And if you remember, Phil mentioned the quadrature. He had this picture where essentially you can take, you can have one out of four points to represent what you're sending on the wire. And you can have two bits of information actually encoded into one bit that you're sending along the wire. And it's essentially what helps you get information across faster. So essentially you're doubling your speed because instead of sending 20 bits, you only send 10. Because you're doing some fancy mixture of frequency, shifting, and amplitude. So again, I don't know how much of this you'll test. I didn't get this stuff taught to me when I was taking the class, so we'll see. But essentially just know that you can't, I mean logically it's a one and a zero, but when you're sending on the air, it's a wave, so you need some way of signifying which one to keep sending. So there was a typo on this slide. This is in black. So I don't know if anyone of you caught it. I'm like, it only tends to apparently. It's at 35. It's supposed to be 45. So signal noise and interference, a big deal. And I dumbed it down just so I can remember. So the signal is what you're sending. Oh, Ben, you're on my slide.
Yeah.
So signal is essentially me talking and I'm trying to get some information across. Noise is, I was with flight earlier, so my ears are ringing pretty badly. So noise is essentially what you get around the transmitting point. It can be hardware, like the pieces inside get hot, so there's like environmental noise that you can get. And then the interference is other, again, the microwaves. It can be other wireless devices that are on the same frequency and whatnot. So Ben is talking in the back. But again, just a note. So this is log scale. So if you're doing signal to noise and interference ratio, essentially what you're doing is you are taking 95 minus 58 is 45. And then the signs cancel. So this is why I pointed out the typo, because otherwise it's like 50 over 95 equals 35 doesn't make any sense. But because it's a log scale, you essentially have to do it. And I hope they don't give you any math. So the reason signal noise and interference is important because if your noise and interference is so loud, your signal gets lost and packets get lost and means you retransmit. And it's one of those things that you don't get on the wire. So the internet cable doesn't get any interference with any environmental. People literally lose packets because someone walked. So they have test beds and wireless stuff in Bell Berkeley. And you look at the traces and it's like, well, we had a meeting and someone didn't have a chair, so they walked into the room where the test bed is and they took a chair, so they moved furniture and it caused it to drop like 150 packets. So it's just it's very different from the wired portal. So Phil did mention collision avoidance versus collision detection. Again, it is pretty much impossible for you to detect a collision because the other sound, the other signal was so quiet that you wouldn't be able to hear it or be able to move. So instead, what they do is collision avoidance. So if I want to send a packet, I have to send a packet. If I hear anything, if I don't hear anything, I send my packet. And hope it gets there fine. If I hear someone else transmitting, I just back off, and you do those exponential backoffs with a little bit of randomization so that if Derek and I try to send at the same time and the channel's busy, if both of us back off for the same amount of time, I mean, we'll be back in the same situation essentially. Is there anything too fancy? Except that you have to realize that if you sense the channel is clear and you send your packet, it is still possible that it collides somewhere and something happens to it. And Phil mentioned hidden terminal problem. Anyone? Volunteers? Does anyone remember what it is? Yeah. Oh, come on. Yeah, go ahead. Oh, don't look behind you, Eric. Come on. Come on, I want to torture someone. someone.
So like if you have kind of three in a row and you're trying and one of the end nodes gets cleared top to the middle node,
right,
then the node on the far end might never have gotten the request from the first node, and so it doesn't know that the first node is out there, and it can transmit at the same time and mess up.
Yeah, so essentially that happens even when you don't have the requests. And I mean, you can, so for me, it really helps to think about these things in simple terms and examples. And if I stand right here, the three TAs are sort of in a row, and if I can hear Derek, I can say, hey, can I send you a packet? Or I can just sense the channel and I see that it's quiet, so I know I can talk to him. Well, at the same time, Ben, who I can't hear at all because he's in the back of the room, Ben can say, Noah's talking to Derek, I can tell him something. So since I can't hear Ben, the two of us start talking at the same time, and the poor guy here in the middle freaks out because he's hearing two people, the packets collide, and, you know, gets messy. So essentially that's the point. And this happens because it's wireless, right? We're not on the same wire, so who knows? I mean, and on a good day, I could be able to hear Ben, and then something goes wrong, and someone puts a chair in between, and the channel goes bad, right? So one of the ways to get around it is this RTS-CTS thing that Phil mentioned. It's essentially, it's a sensor request to send, clear to send. So I would, 802.11 supposedly has that. So I can send a little packet that says, hey Ben, I want to tell you about my trip, so, you know, can I talk to you for 15 minutes? And then he's going to reserve his channel so I can talk to him. And anyone else who tries to talk to him, talking to her. So in practice, Phil mentioned this, in practice this is not used in 802.11 because for every packet I want to send, there's another two packets of overhead because I need to send my request to send. I need to get back the clear to send, so that's already two packets. Then I'm ready to send my packet, and even that doesn't guarantee me that my packet will get across because all sorts of other crap can go wrong. But it's this is an issue, one way to get around it. A guy in our group is working on a grant to send where they like flip a bit in the data packet that says I have five more data packets coming. So that is essentially the same idea. You're trying to reserve the channel for a given duration without actually having the overhead sending extra packets.
Does it clear to send message have, does it say who can send you, or is it just generic?
So clear to send, so good point. So because we have the air, you can have broadcast messages that everyone can hear, and then you can have the unicast messages that everyone can snoop on, but they're addressed to a specific person. So those would be unicast messages. So I would send a specific message to you that says, I want to send you packets. And you know, they can snoop on our conversation, but it doesn't matter. Then you say, okay, you can send me packets. And that's that. Mm-hmm.
So given that Ethernet moved to a switched model, why don't they take wireless and make it so that like every network would make use of all the available channels, and it would multiplex different clients onto different channels so that like an access point could talk with however many channels there are worth of clients at the same time?
So different access points do use different channels.
It's like one access, like a single access point can operate on multiple channels simultaneously.
Yeah.
But why not?
Physically. Aren't you
an E person? I don't know. Well, but shouldn't the channels not interfere so you could have,
if you
like,
have multiple
seven channels?
Well,
that's
yes, I mean, there's like, so 15.4 has 11 channels, 10, like from 16 to 26. But if you want to use all of them at the same time, you have different radios for each one of them, if you want to use them simultaneously. I can use one and then switch to using a different one, but I can't use them at the same time because I only have one radio. I have only one way to actually send the signal. So, I mean, I guess in theory, if you had an access point with like 10 antennas, you could do it, yeah. But usually these things only have one way of sending the signal. That'll be so much interference, though. Who knows? So that was pretty much what I thought was important from the first
terminal problem?
Oh, let's see. Oh, the exposed terminal problem is essentially you have a topology in which you think you might collide with someone. You guys, I don't have that picture. Do you have a slide?
For a user example, let's think. It's where I hear Maria, and I think Maria is interfering with me talking to Ben,
yes.
Which is not right.
Yeah. Okay. So I think if I talk to him, I'm going to interfere with their communication, when really I'm not. Because if I talk to him while if I'm sending him packets while he is sending Ben packets, that's fine. Right? Because he can receive and send at the same time, essentially. Well,
how would he know if you're sending packets if you're sending him packets while he's sending Ben packets? Wouldn't his signal be so many orders of magnitude greater that he'd never hear you?
Yeah, that is true. I don't know.
I think just the fact that I can hear talking to you.
I mean, there is essentially, I can start, there is some very tiny, so we're talking about like nanoseconds or something. There is very tiny time lag during which I can start sending a packet, and by the time he is done sending his packet to Ben, he'll start receiving mine.
Okay.
But I'm not going to do it. Because I think that when I start sending mine, I think that Ben will be able to hear me.
Mm-hmm.
And if that were the case, if I started sending my packet, and then he starts sending his packet to Ben, and Ben could hear both of them, then you know he'll freak out because he's only hearing two packets. Yet there are cases, and this is again, it's tricky, right? Because if it's a broadcast packet, that's when it messes up. But if I'm broadcasting a packet and I think Ben can hear me, if I think both of them can hear me, then he can't transmit anything, right? But if I just want to send him a packet while I'm transmitting, like essentially while I'm pushing my packet out of my queue, he can in the meantime transmit a packet to Ben. And it's just, there's like ways to work around these things, but in reality, sometimes, so we've been looking at stuff and we'll mention it, sometimes for 500 milliseconds, I can hear Ben. Routing. And what is this, lecture 13? So you guys are not stupid. You understand that wireless is different. You know, you understand that the links, so the links are dynamic, so there's all these changes happening. And the other thing is, a lot of the devices that we use with wireless are battery constrained. So if I want to get a packet to you and I'm like with cell phone, I can't just retransmit infinitely or like a really large number, because it kills my battery. So this is the biggest issue that we run into when we do wireless routing. It's not like, you know, usual TCP in the wired world. You can have end-to-end guarantees, and you can transmit the packets, and you can retransmit the acts, and you can like wait and do all these things. You can't really afford to do that because some of these things have tiny, tiny batteries and supposedly need to last 3 years or at least a year. So, I mean, the energy efficiency is a big deal when you do wireless routing. And again, you have, in the wireless, you have the node failures or whatever, node crashes, bad nodes that were erode or something. So you can have the nodes disappear, you can have the links disappear, and all of these things mess up the protocols, can cause loops and those things. And then Phil went through an array of routing protocols. For each, again, disclaimer, if you have very specific questions, you can ask me, but I'll probably have to look at the papers because all of these are research papers that people work on. But essentially the main ideas. So loops, there are some ways to get around loops in the wired. In the wireless, it's even trickier because you can like think that you have a path through your parent node, and then your parent disappears for 15 milliseconds, and then they come back, and there's all these weird things happening. So what DSDB does, this big thing, is the destination sequence number, so that the route you advertise is tied to some sequence number so that you can keep track of what goes on in the network. So if you hear a new sequence for some destination, if you hear about people think that 5 is the best one that we have in our network, and all of you guys start sending me packets, and I don't have a route anymore, then it's, you know, shit goes out, potentially. Seriously. I mean, packets get lost. People lose thousands of packets, especially if you're using a high bit rate. So DSDB, Phil didn't make this clear, but essentially with the routing protocols, you have the proactive ones and the reactive ones. So DSDB is proactive because it maintains routes all the time continuously, regardless of whether you're going to have a data packet to send. It's a little expensive because you have to send essentially periodic broadcast messages saying who do you have a route to, who do you have a route to. And if you don't have any data to send, it gets a little, it's a little funny, right? Because you're paying the price for maintaining routes that might go bad before you've even used them. Because I can advertise a route to Ben and not actually use it, and then a minute later that route is gone. But that's what it does. And this is, I guess, why Phil made the point that you don't want to send too many route advertisements. So in the slides, he was talking about, I guess you call it damping time. So you don't want to advertise a new route right away when something changes, but you want to use some sort of windowed estimated or weighted average to calculate a settlement time so that I wait maybe 500 milliseconds before advertising my new route in case in those 500 milliseconds it changed a lot of times. That's the issue with sending too many packets, which was the better. So yeah, DSDB, there isn't really anything fancy about it except this idea of the destination sequence. So AODV, ad hoc, on-demand, distance vector, they kept the destination sequence number, again, mainly to prevent loops. There's no guarantees, but it does show most of the time. And compared to the other one, this one is proactive, which means that you only look for a route when you have a packet to send. And if you don't care where the destination is, you don't care. You're not sending any broadcast messages. You're not sending any, you're not doing any periodic maintenance on the network, essentially. And so Phil mentioned that AODV uses controlled flooding. Essentially, first I send a packet, I flood the packet to all my one hop neighbors and then my two hop neighbors and so on. Why? Anyone? Just common sense?
There's not 1,000 packets in the network?
Yeah, well, wait. Maybe you want to have 1,000 packets. Right, why don't you want to have 1,000 packets in the network? Collisions and energy. Right. It's really, really concerned. Every single research paper I read, the last thing I want to see is a paper that proposes something and never told me what the overhead is in terms of energy. Because we're working on these tiny devices where I can kill the battery in an hour. I mean, Sunspots came to give a talk last week. They were like, here's this device, and you can use it for 7 hours before recharging it. And people are talking about using devices, wireless devices, to monitor, like, I don't know, wildlife and trees and stuff in the forest. So you don't want to go to the forest and use 7 hours to recharge. So essentially, there's all these smart things that people try to do, limit the scope of the flooding, essentially, to use the rest. Yeah, so AODV, if I need to send a packet to someone and I don't have a route, I'm going to broadcast, essentially flood my route request. And if someone has a route to the destination, they will reply back to me. Worst case scenario, no one has an idea how to get to Ben, so slowly my route request will flood the entire network, get to Ben, and he'll use the reverse route to reply to it and sort of set up the path. So you can see how, you know, these people sort of do a little bit of work and then someone else builds upon it. So DSDB identified the usefulness of destination sequence numbers. Then you go to AODV, who keep that, but limit the flooding, do a little bit different, try to preserve energy by not constantly maintaining routes and whatnot. And then you get to OSR, which, my God, I'm just going to glance over. Because we have to read this for 344, and you know the details are not pretty. But essentially, they what they do is they say, yes, we all know that flooding is bad because it's waste energy, because there's collisions, like you said, and whatnot. So instead of doing this flood one hop, flood two hop, they pick their multi-point relays, the MPRs. So essentially, they identify specific nodes in the network that are going to be responsible for the flooding, so that not everyone gets the packet, not everyone floods, and bottom line is it saves energy. So that's their contribution, their way of building AOD. It's how research works. Cool, cool, you want to have academia functions. Yeah, so you have, so obviously you know all of your neighbors who you can hear, and then through your NPRs, you know your two hop neighbors. Because if you're an NPR for me, then you can hear all the people in the back, and I can hear all the people in the front, and then through you, I know how to get to all those people. And then you can do periodic hello messages. I wonder if computer science is ever going to get rid of these hello world examples. But yeah, so periodically we do the hello messages to make sure that we still have a link, and you tell me who you can connect me to, and I know who I can get connected to in my local neighborhood, and using that, and then flooding the link state information through the NPR so you have to get to anyone in the network. But essentially, if something in my neighborhood changes or if our link changes, I'm not going to send it to everyone. I'm just going to send that message to you, and then you're going to flood it to the NPRs. And it's what Phil, I'm blanking out of the exact word, but what Phil said, essentially the NPRs cover all of the nodes. So if I give it to you, I know that you're going to distribute to your guys when necessary. So if they want to talk to me. Oh yeah, I have the route here. So it's again striving to minimize the flooding. It's all wireless wants you or to do minimize how much energy you use, minimize the overhead in terms of packets, so you don't have collisions. So far we were talking about hops, right, which makes perfect sense in the wired world. I mean, we're like one wire apart, so we're one hop. And that's a little tricky in the wireless world, because sometimes you can hear me, so we're one hop, and sometimes you can't hear me, so then are we like zero hops, are we two hops, who knows what. And the problem with just using hop count as your link cost metric is, again, going back to the signal, the noise, and the interference. Generally, nodes that are farther apart will have weaker signal between the two. It is not a line that just goes like that, right? It's possible that I can sort of hear you, but really hear you, and sort of hear you, and really hear you, right? Because it's not a perfect circle of my reception. But generally speaking, I'm less likely to hear from Ben than I'm to hear. So if you are trying on your route to minimize the hop count of the route, by default, you're more likely to pick nodes that are further apart. Because I can either do 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, or I can do 1, 2, with sort of good lengths. I thought they were pretty good, but they're more likely to die on me because they're further apart. So yeah, usually doing the hop count thing does not work very well. It's possible that you sent one packet and you got it through and you think that you have a link with someone, but they're really far away, and then for the next 10 minutes you can't hear it at all. So they're not really your neighbor. So people, who is this? This is like the MIT people, I think, proposed ETX, which is essentially a different cost metric that doesn't rely on hop count. And it's essentially, the way to think about it is, how many times do I need to transmit a packet in order to hear an ACK DAC? And this is not end-to-end, so this is like a single hop. I'm sending a packet to Derek. So if we have a perfect link, I send the packet once, and he sends one ACK DAC. And, you know, I essentially get one. This is PRR, is packet reception ratio. So the percentage of packets that go across. ARR is ACK reception ratio. So essentially, the ACK is okay with that. If I'll send the packet. Not hear anything. I'll send the packet. Not hear anything. I'll send the packet the third time. He'll get it. Then he'll send an ACK. The ACK will get lost somewhere. He'll send the second ACK, and I'll get it. So essentially, that's 5 transmissions to get 1 packet across. And that's a much better estimate of how expensive, essentially, a path is. Because if I took the longer path of 5 hops to Bend, and I had, you know, say perfect planes or 99.97, then it will take me 1 transmission, and I get an ACK, 2, whatever, 10, let's say, right? Because I transmit the packet 5 times along with 5 hops, and then I get, each person gets an ACK. If I think that Ben and I want to hop away, but our link quality is 10%, that means that I have to transmit my packet 10 times to get it there once, and he has to transmit his ACK 10 times to get it to me once. So worst case scenario, we have to do 20 packets to send 1 packet. So you can see how this breaks. You can't just think of it in terms of hops. There might be a round that seems longer because you're using more nodes along the path, but it actually takes fewer transmissions and it goes back to not wasting the energy, and I have no idea who did ETT, honestly, but essentially it's the idea that 802.11 has different bit rates. So sending 1 packet at 1 megabit per second takes much longer than sending it at 11 megabits per second. So clearly I would want to send it at 11, because then I can send it again. So it's the idea of looking at what the environment is at the moment and what is the best rate that you can pick, taking into account how fast can you get your data across and how stable is the link.
ETX is measured in real time using actual data and ACK packets, or
yes.
Dummy? Okay.
So originally the way they did it actually is they did not use data packets, they only used periodic broadcasts. So every 500 milliseconds I send a broadcast, and if he replies back, then you know we have a good link. If he doesn't reply, it might the quality degrades, right? Because you're averaging. Well, that turned out to be a problem for people, because if you're only checking up on the link every 500 milliseconds, but are sending data every 10 milliseconds, then you can see how there is it's not coherent. Your information is not as crisp, and it's not on the time scale at which you're actually using. So
all the nodes keep a running tab of packet reception and packet
reception.
Right.
So what we do now is. I guess for wireless sensor networks, they use a protocol called CTP that actually uses broadcasts when there isn't enough data, but at the same time, it uses the data to see what the link quality is as well. So it combines essentially the control packets with the data packets to get a more accurate estimate. Because if you're sending a lot of data, then I know what's going on. You know, I know the packets are getting lost. Why not use that in my
How could, like, so any given node is going to keep a running tab of the PR and the AR. But how do you know the actual AR? Like, how do they know how many packs actually exist? It just knows how many you can receive,
right? Right. So nodes advertise to each other, essentially. So you tell me what link quality you're seeing from me. And I tell you what quality I'm seeing from you. And I mean, and you can tell if ACKs are getting lost, because if I send you a packet, I don't get an ACK, I know it got lost, or something happened to it, right? What I don't know is whether my packet got to you. So you tell me if you're getting my packets, and I tell you if I'm getting your ACKs. And this is just a piece of information. It's state information that you can put in one of those distance vectors table entries that you're sending around, instead of the op-amp, right? And yeah, this is like on per link basis, so if you're trying to estimate your path in TX, you just sum them up, and then you get some cost. Apparently TX is a big deal. I didn't know about it until I came here, but man, they're proud of it. And then the last one he mentioned is routing, you know, if I'm sending a packet, I can specify that I definitely want my packet to go through Eric and get to Ben. So I specify somewhere all of the hops. I don't know the details for the security issues that Phil mentioned, how they allow it. But essentially, SRCR uses something like that, and it combines this knowledge of ETT and ETX to achieve better routing. So it uses broadcast packets to estimate the ETX of the link, so you can pick a good link. At the same time, you don't want to just use 1 megabit all the time because you're using AOT.11. So if your links are very good, you're going to take advantage of that and use 11 megabit. If they start to degrade, then you might want to use something slower, essentially. Phil didn't know too much detail about this, so I don't know how much we'll expect. And I guess the cool part about SRCR is the bit rate adaptation algorithm. Essentially, how you decide when you decide to switch from 6 megabit to 11 megabit, and all this stuff is very clear and visible, so I didn't bother, you know, copy pasting. You're going to enjoy this one. Okay, and the last lecture was on our coding stuff, which I hope to enjoy. I personally didn't know a lot of the stuff, so I knew that the overall idea, so it was interesting for me to listen. I was working on these last slides on Saturday. I'm sitting there with my friend who's a chemistry major. I'm like, CRCs. And he goes, can't remember crap. So, yeah, sure. CRCs. Sometimes because Stanford can't remember crap. I thought I'd put it. But you guys all dealt with this in, right, in some form of checksums are essentially the same thing. So this is on the physical layer, and you do it in hopes to recover from some errors. So if you have n bits of data in your packet or data in headers, you can sort of distill that into what is it, C, it's cyclic rhythms. Check in hopes that when the packet gets on the other side, you can recover from one bit errors or up to C. And Phil glossed over the MAC thing, message optimization code, which is essentially the same thing, except someone had a question about this in class, except that you seed your calculation with a random number that the other person knows. So when you did your checksums, you know, we had questions about this. Essentially, you needed to have the checksum field equal to zero when you do the calculation, right? So if you're doing if you're trying to do something fancier, more secure, you have a secret number, and then you factor that into your calculations. Does anyone know what Galois fields are? So.
I mean, fields are just like think addition, subtraction, all of those different nice properties you want.
Phil said he's not going to test you. I am apparently I really like prime numbers, and Galois fields are over prime numbers. I just find them fascinating. I know it's dorky. So Phil's slides claim that CDs use Galois fields over 256. No, it's not a prime number. I asked, 256 is actually an even number, so it's divisible by at least 2. So this one said, oh, no, it's over 255. Sort of, yeah, getting there, right? My guess is over 257, because it's a prime number. If anyone, again, if anyone's anal retentive like me, I think it's over 257, in case, you know, like Phil said, anyone buys CDs anymore. So the big home on stuff, let's see, this is essentially what they use on the CDs, on the music things. The math and stuff. So you treat the data like a polynomial of degree k minus 1, and if you have k data points, so you have one more than the degree, you can essentially recreate your polynomial.
What does that mean to treat the data in polynomial?
That's a very good question. Does anyone have an answer? I don't know how exactly they do it.
It's like when you have k minus 1, what is the k you think about? Is that the length of the data you're trying to encode?
So I would imagine that, you know, we have like n bits, and there's some algorithm, there's some mathematical way of taking the n bits and creating a polynomial, and the degree is probably a function of the length of the paper. That would be my guess, but I don't know in details how they do it.
So it's not
anyone? No.
So if, like the data could be of length greater than like your original data.
Yeah. Larger than k. Those sort of said no, but I don't know the details. I mean, I'm sure there's some method in which you can treat bits as a polynomial. Like you can think of like really random things. Like if my first 8 bits are 1111000, I can just say that I take this and I convert it to like a decimal number. And that's the coefficient to like the first element of my polynomial, right?
Right.
And then you treat it. It's like it's arbitrary. It's just a matter of representation. So I can say if I have data that's 10 bytes, then I can be like, okay, so my polynomial is going to have 10 elements in it, right? So it's going to be 9, and then each one of the bytes is going to be a coefficient to probably not how to do it. Doesn't sound very efficient to me, but you can see how, and then they probably have fancier ways to do it so that they can back when they do.
So you think it's probably using the data as coefficients and not as like, okay.
I mean, it's a polynomial, there's nothing else.
Yeah.
But it's coefficients, right? So I would assume that you take the data and somehow you use it to make the coefficients of the polynomial. And as far as what the degree of the polynomial is, I don't know if there's just a preset way of doing it. I mean, I would assume so, because if Phil's notes said something about like 253 over 233.
The number of data.
Send 223 data symbols and 32 of them are redundant, essentially. So if you're sending, if 223 is enough, then I would assume that your polynomial is like a degree, so I don't know how to pick that key. Look, if you knew that, you would be able to steal music illegally. You're not supposed to know that kind of stuff. It's a secret. But it's sort of the IDA school, because essentially this is how you get the redundancy. If you only need k points to recreate your polynomial, which is the data, then if you send, you know, 2k points, then you can tolerate half of them getting corrupted or lost, just crashed on the CD, getting like maybe certain points. You can watch that.
Are you treating the polynomial as some kind of function that you're getting points from? I mean, how do you get points from the polynomial, I guess?
I presume that since it's a CD, you have an analog signal, and you want it to, you just sample it, oversample it, right? And then like, if some points get lost, basically, then you can like reconstruct the other, like you can reconstruct the other points in the sampled wave. That's the basic idea. I mean, like if you think about it like intuitively, you have to put some like restriction on these. If you just have a bunch of digital points, I can draw an infinite number of curves
right
through those points, right? So you have to put some restriction through how you're going to turn that digital signal back to the analog signal. And so you just put some arbitrary restriction on it so that you can create, you know, reconstruct the signal. I think that's an intuitive idea.
Some kind of like known interpolation scheme to get the rest?
Well, you don't need the rest. You need k of them.
Okay.
And k points give you a polynomial. The thing is, what you say is that you have to make sure that you can't get two different polynomials out of the same.
Yeah, same set of points, right? Because if I just put like 3 points on a line, I can draw like an infinite number of like curves that go through those 3 points. The question is how do you actually reconstruct the actual signal? Like, that's the
you're not actually manipulating points.
Yeah.
Right. This is what MP3s do, what you're suggesting. Essentially, they take the analog signal and they subsample points so that instead of, you know, 100,000 data points, you have 50,000, so the MP3 is really small, but the quality is a question. So that's different. In this case, if you have k points, you can get the data, essentially. So then you can tolerate the loss or corruption of the extra points that you working with people who like, you know, make CDs for this map and stuff. Oh god. Yeah. I'll keep it to present this paper on it's really up to this. Yeah, so this was again, you can see how they have this idea of how, okay, we're gonna give you 150 data points and you can use lose 50 of them and 100 is still enough. So then they build onto this stuff, and that's not the computer science people, that's the math people now that are doing their research and building on other people's work. So you get these erasure codes where you can generate a bunch of packets and only a subset of them is enough to regenerate the data. And the cool thing is, I'm gonna go through the slide, but really the cool thing is that you need like whatever k packets, but it could be any packets, which means that you don't care. I mean, obviously packets get lost, and you care how many get lost because you want to receive k of them, but you don't care which ones got lost, which is really cool because it allows you to get rid of the state you're keeping. And this is why when we're talking about this stuff, Bill prefaces it by saying, what if you have a large piece of information and you want to send it to 1,000, whatever, 100,000, a million clients? You don't want to keep state for all of them. And stuff like this allows you to get rid of the state because you don't need the end-to-end reliability in the way we thought about it when we talked about TCP. Because I don't need to know that you got packets 4, 5, 6, and 7, and lost 8. I just need to send until you finally send it back, essentially accumulate it back in a way that says, I have enough packets, stop sending. So it's, you know, it's really useful because it can get very, purely from a physical standpoint of view, it can get very difficult to keep track of who you send what in terms of memory, right? So yeah, the big thing was the LT codes. LT stands for Luby Tornado. Luby, named the guy who created them, Tornado, because similar codes are called Tornado codes. It has something to do with tornadoes, but anyway, it's like serious stuff, you know, serious math stuff. And what they do is, so you have a big piece of data, like a multimedia file or something, you break it into chunks, and you export them, and all the fancy math goes into how many chunks you XOR together. So you can do one, which essentially means you didn't XOR anything, you just have a pure chunk of data. Or you can XOR two of them, or you can go up to so, from what I understand, and I haven't looked at the paper yet. Did anyone look at the paper?
It's not too bad. It's pretty bad.
Okay, so that should be the business tip for next Monday. So I haven't looked at the paper, but from what I understand, really, Phil likes to say, the intellectual thrust is into figuring out how to figure out the degrees of these XOR chunks, so that when you get them on the other side, you have enough to XOR them, to XOR data out of them, essentially. And the way it works is, if you have these chunks, you can, like he said, it's like a fountain. You can just XOR packets randomly all the time. I mean, even if I have 100 packets, I can keep XORing them forever. And you send them to the other side, and if I get a packet that has, it wasn't XORed, it was just one chunk, then obviously I know that piece of data. And having that piece of data, I can use it to look at other packets and XOR new pieces of data. So if I got A, and I also got A XORed with B, having those two, I can get out B. So now I have A and B. And then if I had B XORed with C, I can get C. And then if I had like D with E, I keep it around because I can't XOR anything out of it. So it's essentially this process of you getting new data and trying to XOR all the original chunks. Yeah, I don't know how they do it, but it's, sorry, I sound like Phil, but it's sort of like magic to me, too. Maybe after I read the paper.
It's not too bad.
Is there a lot of math? Or?
Well, there's an example, so. Yeah, I was a math major, so to me it wasn't a lot of that.
I'm sure I'll enjoy it. I don't know if I'll understand it. So, yeah, that's good enough. But yeah, so essentially, you're guaranteed to eventually be able to recover your data, and it's really we, the networking people, you know, sort of lazy. Everyone else did all the work, so we decided to take it into network coding and just sort of touch the network and to use it for our own device. And the cool thing about wireless is, I mean, I guess it's the worst thing that it's a broadcast medium because you get all the interference, but it's also really cool because you can do these cool tricks like network coding. So essentially, what Moore did, it's another research paper out of MIT. essentially, if I'm trying to send data, I break it into chunks of packets, essentially, and I do linear combinations of them, and I can send them forward into the network. And in this case, I'm not restricting myself to having only one person forward my packets. I can have three people, like three of my best neighbors, forward the packets, because it doesn't matter if the other side gets them. Chances are they'll be useful on the other side because all of them are random linear combinations. And you can see how you can't do that if you're doing just regular sending. Because if I'm sending a specific packet, it doesn't make sense for me to say, you forward it, you forward it, you forward it. It makes sense for one person to forward it because otherwise I'm going to get duplicates. But if I'm actually just generating these linear combinations, like you're going to get a bunch of them, and you're going to get some of them and some new ones. And then as you pass them through the network, my destination will eventually be able to take the data that's in the packet and do a matrix inversion and get it out. So that's what they did, essentially the idea of opportunistic perception, that you just send packets until the person on the other side says, you know, I have enough packets that now I can do the essentially reverse those linear combinations and get the data out. And just put it on the bottom, this is my last slide. And yeah, the bidirectional network coding is the idea. I don't know, do you guys remember the picture from lecture? It's essentially, I send you a packet that you have to give to Ben, and Ben sends you a packet that you have to give to me. So that's already two packets that we've sent to him, and now he has my packet. And instead of sending two more packets out, he can actually XOR them and use the packet to broadcast them. Broadcast the XOR packet, so he'll put it in somewhere. So if I send A and then send C, you can XOR A and C, and I hear it, so now I have A and I have A plus C, so I can get C out of it. And similarly, Ben now has C and A XOR and C, it's like, I don't know, I was visiting MIT and that's what that woman made me do. Like, I went to her office, a professor, and she was like, here, sit down. How can we transmit two packets using only three transmissions if you're using an intermediate node? I'm like, I don't know. I'm tired. I'm visiting grad schools. You're not supposed to ask me questions. You're supposed to make me feel wanted or something. She's like, well, here's how we can do it. And essentially, that's what she did, right? And in three transmissions, you get two packets across using their intermediate node. So it's pretty neat. And you know, their biggest argument saves energy. Guys, it's really important. Like there's all the sciencey people, like the natural sciences, that come and say, there's sea lions and we want to know where they go. Give us tiny devices that can collect data and that will last for 6 months until we can find the sea lion and take our device back. And there's a guy in my office that was showing me pictures that he taped this like sensor thing that with AA batteries on the back of a sea lion in Southern California. Or no, University of Santa Cruz, maybe, so I guess it's around here. And we have two AA batteries and some damn sea lion is swimming in the ocean. You can be, you know, there's other sea lions obviously forming their networks. You can't just flood packets. It sounds ridiculous, but it's true. It's like the batteries that you put in your camera and you change, if you go out for a night and take like 150 pictures. And they want to monitor this for, you know, 6 months. So it's very important that they're counting every tiny packet they send. So it's pretty important. Don't flap. Do you have any questions? I really like llamas, but then it turned out that llama was apparently a language. have any wireless questions, you can bug me. If not, as I said at the beginning, once you do the exam, I will sit down with Phil and get a clear sense of what from the wireless you need to know.
Is the exam cumulative?
Yes. Yes. And from my impression, it's also longer because it's during exam week. Room free.